The drought monitor map was updated this morning. Laura Edwards is the SDSU Extension State Climatologist, and she joins us now from Aberdeen with an update. Laura, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Great to be with you again.
What do we know this week about how things are unfolding?
We are seeing drought intensifying again over the last couple of weeks as we've really fallen short on rainfall again. Last week, very little rainfall across the state, just a few spots here and there in the northeast corner, northwest corner. But we did see drought expand now about 95% of the state in some level of drought and increase in severity, especially along the Missouri River and the southeastern part of the state around Yankton, Vermilion, Charles, Mix County.
The impacts of this continue to grow. What does it look like historically? How bad is this compared to other droughts that we've been through since the drought monitor began?
Yeah, the drought monitor has been around since about 1999-2000, and we're looking at some precipitation data, especially that southeast corner that has really fallen short over the last 30 days. For the growing season so far, since April 1st, we've seen precipitation records now right challenging with 1936, which is the Dust Bowl era, the 34 to 36 time period. So we're seeing some record dry years, first, second, third ranking dry years now in that southeast corner of the state. But we are seeing impacts increase all over with the heat as well that we've seen this last week with highs in the 90s and 100s. We're seeing the corn crop with ears starting to drop and dry out prematurely, soybean plants turning early, and a lot of sunflowers also progressing through their growth stage very quickly.
Wow.
We did hear just a little bit ago about gardening, and that's another thing. Backyard gardens are starting to suffer as well.
Gardens are suffering as well. Tell me a little bit about what the outlook is for the next week or so.
You know, we're actually looking at a pretty positive outlook, I'd say, as far as moisture goes. In the next week, 7 days, we're expecting some more rainfall across the eastern part of the state, starting tonight into tomorrow. We're going to kind of see a wet pattern move across the state, hopefully about an inch of rain or more tomorrow in some parts of the east. And for the weekly total of the next 7 days, we could see up to 2 inches in some parts of the far north and the east. So might be too late a little bit for some of our agricultural crops, but will help us on the gardening side, backyards, trees, that kind of thing, and hopefully reduce our fire risk as a lot of vegetation is really dry out there.
Yeah, we will take every bit that we can. Laura Edwards is the SDSU Extension State Climatologist. We'll talk with South Dakotans impacted by the drought tomorrow on In the Moment. Laura, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you, Lori.
Ahead on the program, SDPB's Lee Strubinger has an update on state social studies standards revision. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
An ICU nurse has been traveling from state to state to help hospitals and patients in COVID-19 hotspots.
I hold their hand and I say, we're going to get through this. But after we get through this, you need to go get vaccinated. This is why we're here and this is why we're having this conversation.
What it's like now to treat COVID-19 patients and the latest news from Afghanistan and Haiti. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda in Rapid City. Inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda. See you at Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda, Rapid City.
Over the past year or so, we've learned to expect the unexpected. Stories change, news breaks, and then breaks again. We'll be feeling the changes for years to come and in ways we can't yet imagine. NPR is here to keep you connected and informed, to be a vital resource in a changing world. Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB.
Program funding by TSP. Started as a one-person architecture practice in 1930, now a thriving multidisciplinary design firm. Discovering facility solutions that make South Dakota communities better by design. More at TeamTSP.com.
Politics and Public Policy Reporting is supported by the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. In just over a month, public hearings will begin on a draft of social studies content standards for South Dakota K through 12 students. The Department of Education released those standards over a week ago with several changes. The department's secretary testified before a legislative committee yesterday. SDPB's Lee Sturbinger joins us now from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City to recap the hearing. Hey, Lee, welcome.
Hey, Lori. Good to be here.
Remind us quickly why the state is looking at social studies curriculum right now.
Yeah, so it's part of a routine look at what's called content standards. The state has a working group of experts from across the state revise and rework those standards. And the last time it was done was in 2015. So a group of about 40 educators and historians came together over the course of 8 days and looked at three major things: U.S. history and American government, Native American history and tribal government, and South Dakota history and government. And they looked at those three things and divided them into four main subjects and updated those subjects in, history, civics, geography, and economics.
Help us understand the difference between content standards and actual curriculum.
Yeah, so standards set the minimum of what is taught and what is expected of students to learn at each grade level. You know, teachers can go beyond those standards, and curriculum is more of how those standards are taught. And so those standards are what the Department of Education expects for students when they graduate from a certain grade or move on from a certain grade. For example, one of the draft standards expected of fifth graders in the draft that the Department of Education released was identify the basic structure of government by studying the United States Constitution and explaining why the United States was established as a republic. That's just kind of an example.
Sure. Well, when the Department of Education released its draft standards, they were different from what the working group submitted to the Department of Education. Is that why the Secretary of Education, Tiffany Sanderson, was before a legislative committee yesterday?
Secretary Sanderson was there to provide an update on where the content standards process is now. Sanderson did get up there to say that media reports about the content standards and those changes didn't reflect what actually happened.
Some of the recent narrative that you've heard might make it seem like the department is now proposing or recommending to erase all teaching or learning around Native American history or government, and that's absolutely false.
But Sanderson says the Department of Education did make changes to the work group's recommendation to ensure that schools have the ability to teach about all cultures that make up the fabric of South Dakota, including Ocheti Chicoan people. And real quick, Ocheti Chicoan is a term that is used to recognize tribal communities within South Dakota. And Sanderson says the proposed changes are more inclusive than the ones that were in place in 2015.
Examples of additional ways that schools could address cultural teaching include our Karen population and the culture of our Hispanic students, our Somali students, and our Czech students, just as examples. Of course, there are many, many cultures that make up the South Dakota demographics.
So, theoretically, teachers can go beyond what the content standards say, but if you do a quick search of the standards that the Department of Education released, there isn't anything in there about the Karen population or Hispanic or Somali or Czech students.
So give us an example of two content standards side by side that are different than about how the Department of Education would be different from the proposed standard.
Yeah, so let's take fourth graders' state history, for example. The Department of Education's draft says, describe the influences of various cultures on South Dakota communities. What the working group draft content standards used to say was explain how the Ocheti Chicoan and Oyate culture and other groups were affected by westward expansion, the creation of the reservation system, and the U.S. assimilation policies and programs. So that was one example of a change that took place by the Department of Education. Paul Harnes is a retired teacher from Yankton who served as a high school world history lead during the content standards review. He says the working group's draft of content standards allow for teaching of all cultures that make up South Dakota, but he says what the Department of Education revisions did was shortchange what Native Americans experienced.
Because it specifically talked about what happened with the Western expansion and to the Native Americans and other groups. It's not just the Native Americans. And I think one of the examples I remember which was being used was the expansion of the Germans, the Danes, and all those coming in, and that type of thing. But there was a greater effect upon the Native cultures.
Harnes and some others who were involved on the content standards update are also upset about a preface that was added to that the Department of Education added to the content standards. And he's since asked the Department of Education to remove his name from the draft, which they have.
Was Secretary Sanderson asked about why the Department of Ed made those changes and who suggested them?
No, but I do have a request for those questions out to the Department of Education.
Sure.
And that's something that Harnes and others would like to know. When the changes were first brought to light, the Department of Education said in a written statement that they made certain adjustments before the release of the draft to provide greater clarity and focus for educators and the public. The draft standards provide a balanced, age-appropriate approach to understanding our nation's history, government, economy, and geography, including opportunities to teach about the experiences of all peoples.
All right, so if the Department of Ed says they made changes to provide the balanced understanding of the nation's history, why did the group word the content standards the way they did?
So Harnes says the group was told on the first day of the eight-day summit looking at the content standards that the 2015 social studies curriculum standards were not inclusive enough. And one of the areas it wasn't inclusive enough in was indigenous tribes in South Dakota. And he says that's the reason why every work group had at least one standard concerning the Ocheti Chicoan Oyate and Native Americans.
I mean, they took most of them out of the standards that we created to make it more inclusive. In fact, there is very little that talks about specifically the histories of the indigenous tribes of South Dakota. In fact, one of the things I know they took out was to identify they were going to have the younger students look at a map of South Dakota and identify the reservations. That's all. And they eliminated that one. I don't understand.
And so that's a geography standard for first graders that was eliminated.
Yeah, we're going to hear from one more person, and this is Cheryl Johnson, Education Director for Sisseton Wahpeton Tribe. And here she is talking about how, as this event progressed, she grew more comfortable being there. Take a listen.
In answering questions and talking about cultural, racial things, identity, and clarifying some of the things that people have just out of ignorance. And so I was in a real safe place to answer questions truthfully for people. And I was really happy about the experience of being able to have history include Native Americans.
A lot more to talk about. We'll leave it there. The conversation is ongoing. Lee Strubinger, thank you so much.
Great. Thanks for having me.
More in the moment after the break on Listener Supported SDPB.
On the next Fresh Air, we explore the reasons for the Taliban's sweeping victory in Afghanistan and consider future prospects for the country with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and New Yorker staff writer Steve Kahl. He's written two books dealing with the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and the role of Pakistan in the conflict. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, One Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding with your support and by McCrory Gardens in Brookings, planting over 40,000 flowers every spring. More information at McCroryGardens.com. McCrory Gardens, ready to bloom.
stay up to date with South Dakota Public Broadcasting, sign up for newsletters from SDPB. You can learn more about what's happening at our studios, get encapsulated news, see previews of specials, and so much more. SDPB in your inbox. Sign up online at sdpb.org.
Program funding is provided by Sanford Underground Research Facility, hosting world-leading research in physics and other disciplines. Learn more about America's Underground Science Laboratory at sanfordlab.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. This month, the SDPB Spotlight illuminates the Black Hills. We've been talking often about the Black Hills National Forest as designated in 1897, but for thousands and thousands of years before that, people lived in the forest and near the forest. It was a place of abundance, food, water, solace, spirit. Craig Howe is founder and director of the Center for American Indian Research and Native Studies. He holds a PhD in architecture and anthropology. There's so much to explore here. In order to march through as much as possible today, we're going to begin the conversation with the first of three U.S. Supreme Court cases that address the people who were here before the U.S. government secured the Louisiana Purchase.
The first one basically said that American Indians have occupancy rights to the land, but they don't really own it. The analog I use is just like a deer or a bear or an elk. You know, they occupy the land, but they cannot alienate it in and of themselves. They can't pass it on, and they have no ownership claim to it. That's essentially what the United States decision in 1823 said. And that if American Indians want to alienate their rights to that land in any way, the only entity they can do that to is the United States of America. So it limited the leverage or the negotiating power of American Indians. They didn't have this way of playing the United States off against other nations in the world as far as bidding for land or with states or with individual Americans, that all that was prohibited. Tribes could only alienate their land to the United States.
All right. Also at this time, there are explorations into this area from, Harney, Lewis and Clark. All kinds of people are coming out and sending word back to Washington about what is exactly there because it hasn't been mapped from the American government perspective. They find, as we mentioned, timber galore. They find minerals, as in gold. They find resources that they want. And that changes everything, doesn't it?
There's a rush to get those resources. And to a young nation, the United States, these resources are seen as being critical. And those entities such as tribal nations that make less than optimal financial use of those, they think as detrimental or less than Americans are.
How do we get to this idea of, a treaty that actually declares this area belongs to these people? Talk to me a little bit about what happens at Fort Laramie, really before the main rush of European American settlers into the area.
And we just have to back up a little bit back to the 1831 and 32 decisions of the Supreme Court. And in the 1832 decision, that's where the decision was made that American Indian tribes have inherent rights. Mm. So these are the rights of these tribes and their citizens prior to the United States. These are inherent rights. They're not given to tribes. And so by 1832, then, U.S. law recognizes that these tribes have these inherent rights prior to the establishment of the United States and not given to them by the United States. So the first treaty then that Lakotas or the Sioux Nation signed was in 1851, and that was the first Fort Laramie Treaty. And that treaty was basically a treaty of friendship between Plains tribes. And the United States was just trying to get everyone to get along, right? But what they did do was demarcate the territories of these tribes. And so in that 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty, the Black Hills are entirely within the lands of the Great Sioux Nation, or Iroquois, as we would say today. 17 years later, there's the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, and those lands are expanded. The lands, and in this case, it's not a treaty of friendship between tribes. It's a treaty of between the United States and the Great Sioux Nation. And the United States essentially is suing for peace. They want the fighting between the United States and the Sioux Nation to end. And so they essentially sue for peace and then agree to all of the terms that the Sioux Nation, mostly represented by Lakotas, demanded. And coincidentally, today, the 18th of August, in 1868, the United States abandoned the third of the three forts that they stipulated they would abandon at the demand of the Great Sioux Nation, and that was Fort Reno. So it's kind of prescient, maybe, that we're talking about this today, but
yeah.
1868 treaty lands had three statuses. There was the Great Sioux Reservation, there was the unceded territory, and then there was the hunting territory. Those are three land statuses that are encompassed or contained in that 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty. And the Black Hills falls entirely within the Great Sioux Reservation.
Hmm. And then am I right in saying that, I mean, there's still this idea that the United States will settle families to, in quotations, civilize and interact with the tribal people, but they'll respect that boundary, and then they no longer decide to do that. Why are all these people allowed to flood into the Black Hills and start the deforestation and the mineral extraction that we see during the gold rush?
Well, historians come on, you know, at least two major viewpoints. One is that the United States permitted it and looked the other way because it was in violation of the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty terms. No non-Indians, the way they phrased it in the treaty is no one who's not a signatory to this treaty, so the Great Sioux Nation. Other than that, no one else is permitted in the Great Sioux Reservation. So any non-Indians who are in the reservation are there in violation of the treaty. There is strong evidence that the United States military did try to enforce the treaty and prevent prospectors and miners from coming into the Black Hills. But after the Custer expedition of 1874, that was it was essentially impossible. They could not do it, and they didn't have the will to do it. So then the United States started different strategies to try to buy the Black Hills from the Great Sioux Nation.
Which was declined, refused, no sale.
Correct. There was no sale. Some of the negotiators, some of the Great Sioux Nation negotiators did have prices, did float some negotiating prices. One was $10 million if the United States wanted to buy it. Others proposed that the United States would lease the Black Hills for seven generations. And then at that time, the Great Sioux Nation would decide whether or not to sell or not. And that was basically, it seems, from my perspective, seems to be the strongest position that the Lakotas were advocating.
Interesting. So by the end of the year in 1874, after news gets out from journalists who are carrying, you know, the news of the expedition to the cities, including St. Paul, there are 15,000 people, more than 15,000 people rush to this area. And
occupy it, enter the space, to chop down trees, stake gold claims.
Yep.
From what you told me about how this space was seen by the people who lived there, that seems to be, it must have been incredibly disruptive and painful and a time of suffering to sort of see this place used in the way it was being used, very extractive and transactional. What are your thoughts on that? How does that land with you?
Yes, that's true. And that that would have been just disheartening, I think. There were a lot of people in the Black Hills, and they were extracting. But in a way, I wonder if it might be the biggest takeaway and the biggest hurt, maybe, from the Sioux Nation perspective, was there's no trust in the United States. They gave the word, and they wouldn't, and, you know, I think the Sioux Nation representatives could think if they wouldn't honor their word, keep their word, the promises that were made in that treaty. And so this distrust gets grounded in strongly, and then the desecration of the place, of the land, is tied in with that. But I think that distrust is what could have been a bigger hurt at that time, mm-hmm. initially, when there was, you know, later when we get the large-scale extraction and deforestation and those type of things, then I think that could take precedent. But initially, it's just this distrust. Hmm.
What else needs to be said that people today need to understand about the Black Hills?
One thing is that the status of the land, I think, is still open. That the Supreme Court did make a decision in 1980 that the land was taken from the Great Sioux Nation. And that the quote, I'm paraphrasing it, but it's basically a more ripe and rank case of dishonorable dealings may never be found in our nation's history. So it's an immoral act that was done. But the Congress of the United States has the power to do that. They have what's called plenary power. And they exercise that plenary power to take that land, all of the Black Hills and all of the land between the what's now called the Cheyenne River and the Belle Fourche Rivers. They took all that land in 1877 against the stipulations in the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty. So again, this distrust of these solemn agreements between these political nations that says in the United States Constitution, these are the supreme law of the land, these treaties are. So this idea of the status of the land, I think, is still open. And there are still people working to right that wrong. And that's on this political and historical side. And on the ceremonial side, you still have people that have never stopped going into the hills and into the Black Hills National Forest to perform ceremonies and to gather plants and other resources that are important in maintaining and perpetuating Lakota culture.
Hmm. What would that look like in the future? What is the way to right the immoral act? Because I remember interviewing Nick Estes, and he said, you know, it's not, and again, I'm paraphrasing him, but he pointed out it's like stealing somebody's car and then driving by their house every day saying, hey, I still have your car. You know, it's not something that just happened in the past. It's something that is continually happening day by day. What corrects the immoral wrong? How does that proceed?
Well, to pick up on that idea of a stolen car, you know, if someone steals your car, when it is recovered, or then it comes back to you. The thief doesn't get to keep it. And so I think, again, the analog there is this land was stolen or taken, And in U.S. law, that should be returned to its owners. Now, because the status of American Indians and Indian tribes, then this whole different legislation comes in, you know, where the United States, by the Indian Claims Commission, they said we can right these wrongs with money, but we will not return land. So there's those obstacles that have to become that we need to overcome, and they have been overcome ever since President Nixon. He was the first president to return land to American Indian tribes, and that was at Taos Blue Lake. So there is a precedent for returning land. The other thing is in the short term, tying back to what those representatives back in the 1860s were talking about was this idea of leasing the land. So that the amazing thing is the United States still has not paid a penny, not one penny for the Black Hills. This is just a shocking fact. Not one penny has been paid by the United States for the Black Hills for 153 years now, or the taking of them in 1877. So it'd be a little less than that. But this idea of this decision that was made in 1980, maybe if we could reimagine that decision, not as a payment for the Black Hills, a purchase for the Black Hills, but as a lease or rent of the Black Hills, it might make it palatable to tribes and tribal communities to accept some of that money on that basis, not as purchase, but as rent.
That's Craig Howe, founder and director of the Center for American Indian Research and Native Studies. You can find all our Spotlight coverage on our website, sdpb.org/spotlight. Let's take a moment now to look at the ingenuity of a young boy living in the Black Hills who had his heart set on just one thing, a Lego space station. Wyatt Dennis had an idea that has been a go-to for children for decades. However, he probably didn't envision his lemonade stand making national news in its second year and more than $15,000 this summer, with much of that money going to his favorite charity.
Me and my mom were sitting on the deck and I was seeing all the bikers go down the highway and I wanted to keep them hydrated, help them out. So we did the lemonade stand last year, and people just started donating. So we had to find everywhere else to put the money, and I just won this because of a Lego. So now 50% goes to college, 35% goes to St. Jude, and 15% goes to a dirt bike. Last year was Lego. I wanted to help kids out, and I wanted to do a charity for kids. So we went through some charities, and we picked St. Jude's. And one of my mom's friends runs for St. Jude's. Last year, we only went through 20 gallons. And what do you know? This year, we probably go through 20 gallons in an hour or less. It's just that they feel inspired, and then I'm inspired by them feeling inspired and coming to my lemonade stand. I got a space station Lego set. Black Hills Riders gave me a pit bike. I just wanted to get a Yamaha, then I'll move up to a Honda, then a Harley. So yes, I will end up with a Harley sometime when I'm older.
Ahead on the program, a South Dakota man pleads for the lives of his family members in Afghanistan. That story is next on In the Moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Program funding by Bangs McCullen Law Firm. From humble beginnings in the Dakota Territory over 130 years ago, now a full-service firm with offices in Sioux Falls and Rapid City. There for you then, here for you now. BangsMcCullen.com.
Miss something on SDPB? Sign up for the SDPB Morning Report. Get the reporting you love straight to your email twice a week. Go more in depth with our statewide coverage, and don't miss critical segments from shows like In the Moment and South Dakota Focus. It's the news you can use, free from clutter, and best of all, free of charge. To sign up for the Morning Report, visit sdpb.org/news and scroll to the bottom.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. First Dakota National Bank celebrates individuals and businesses with a passion to turn their dreams into South Dakota firsts. Learn more at firstdakota.com/first.
Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Salab Naimi became an American citizen this summer at a ceremony at Mount Rushmore. As a young man in Afghanistan, Naimi wanted to go to college, study computer science. The political situation in his nation, however, was desperate, and he put his dreams on hold. He became an interpreter, working with the U.S. Army. In 2014, because of threats to his life, he applied for a visa and traveled to the United States. As he watches the Taliban take over his homeland, city by city, street by street, he is deeply worried about his family. He wants South Dakota's congressional delegation to listen to this interview. He wants Americans to understand what's happening to Afghan civilians as U.S. planes depart. I spoke with Salab Naimi on the phone yesterday. A note to listeners, parts of this interview may be difficult to listen to.
All the rest of my family, my mom, my dad, and I have two brothers, and I have six sisters. They're still living in that really dangerous situation. So I'm talking to them like, since this all situation is going on in Afghanistan, and they're locked themselves at home because they cannot even go out to go to the shop and get food and grocery or anything like that. Everything is very bad, and I'm really worried about like my family. I call them every day, and it really hurts me. It really hurts. Even my two kids were born here. They even didn't know anything about it. And there, when I'm talking to them on the phone, so my kids are asking me like really very complicated questions, and I don't know how to answer that. And they're asking me what is going on with your family, why they're crying, and what is going on. And it really hurts me. I don't know how to help my family, dear, and it is so bad.
They can't even go out to get food. The what are they seeing in the street? What do they think is going to happen? What are they seeing happen? The threat is real and it's very significant. What are you afraid of?
They can decapitated. You know, they can get killed. They can, like, get killed. I have my two sisters. One of them was going to college, and the other one was going to high school. And they're almost like their soul are dead. Like, their body is alive, but their soul are dead because they had a lot of dreams and wishes. And they know that my family, I was working with the U.S. Army, and I live in the United States now. They made them to lock themselves at home because the Taliban are like, they're shooting, like right now, they're shooting people on the streets in Afghanistan, in their city that my family lives. Even like the girls even cannot go out to go to the shop or anything like that. Everything is bad. So my family are like, they feel like they're dead. And they're calling me, and I'm talking to them, but there's nothing I can, like, I don't know how to help them. It's like that now, I'm not even, like, comfortable to go to work because when I'm working, like, my brain, and I'm thinking about my family and all the situation that's happening here right now, it's really make me uncomfortable and really worried, and it made me so sad.
I'm so sorry.
I'm so sorry. What? How often are you able to talk with members of your family? Can you reach them every day? Do you know how long you might be able to reach them?
That's also one of the question that we are all concerning about. Like right now, they have phones, so I can talk to them every day. But right now, like the Taliban, like my family were telling me that like they're burning everything, like maybe the phone, the network, and all the internet that the Afghan people have access over there right now, they probably, you know, destroy that too. So once they're destroyed, there will be no way that I can contact with my family, and I don't know what's going to happen to them.
Your sisters have lived for quite some time a very different life than what we think the Taliban will implement. Was that something you talked about as a family before, specifically just the ability to go out in the street for a girl, the ability to get an education, how special that was? And did you ever think it could go backwards and be taken away again?
We never thought that. Like even my family, we never thought that would happen. Especially for the women and females, it was a very, they had their rights, they could go to colleges, universities, schools, they could have a jobs and work. It's opposite now. In all the new generation in Afghanistan, they're all like, even probably you guys watched some video that in Afghanistan International Airport, like the people were hanging in the airplane and they were trying to get out of the countries. They're like 11 people dead. And the Taliban right now, when the people are coming to the airport, like the Taliban shoot them, especially the women. Like they say, you cannot come to the airport, you know, like because the U.S. forces are in the airport right now, but there's the Taliban all surrounded at the airport. And when the people trying to get to the airport, the Taliban like stop them, abuse them, beat them on the street.
If you could talk right now to South Dakota Senator John Thune or South Dakota Senator Mike Rounds or Congressman Dusty Johnson or President Joseph Biden, what would you say to them? What do you need them to hear?
I need to hear about, like, like I told you, about my family. There are like 1,000 other people that they are in the same situation. And I want them to hear that we really need help. Like, we did sacrifices. And my old family is right now in a race, and they could be, like, killed and dead, and we really need help in this situation. And there's 1,000 other people like me. They're worried about their family. Some of the family member probably already got killed. And we really need help, and we want them to hear our voices and justice.
If you can't get your family out of Afghanistan, do you think the U.S. military should go back in? Do you have a sense of what would be an effective way to create safety for those thousands of people? I know that's a big question. Maybe nobody knows the answer, or it would have already been done. But do you have any insight from living there and from being a translator? Any thoughts on what a possible solution could be moved toward?
Like you said, this is a big question. I'm not in Afghanistan right now, but that's what, like, I'm talking to my families in the social media that I watch. And I think the big solution is that, yeah, of course, like, if the U.S. Troops are back in Afghanistan, I mean, it will definitely bring changes over there to, like, the people who are trying to get out of the country, and they can get help, and they can get out in a safe way, not get killed instead, you know? Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so this is, but if the Taliban, they're, like, they're shut down, if the U.S. forces are not there, the Taliban is going to shut down the airport, or there is no embassy or nothing. So the people are just like stacked here, there will be like a bloodshed on the streets, and including like my family, there's going to be 1,000 other families members that will get killed.
The Little League World Series begins today in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. A team from Sioux Falls sits inside the Tom Seaver Championship teams and begins play tomorrow. In the Moment, producer Chris Loffrey caught up with head coach Mike Gorsett this morning. They begin by talking about the team's journey thus far.
The journey has been a couple years in the making. We've had a team that competed at the 10-year-old all-star level, the 11-year-old all-star level, and now it's 12-year-old. It started about a month and a half ago in district play in Brandon, South Dakota. We advanced out of that to the state tournament, and we won our state tournament about 3 weeks ago now. Last week we went out to regionals, which was in Indianapolis, Indiana. We actually took second at regionals, but this year is a little bit different where normally you would have to win your regional tournament to advance on to Williamsport, Pennsylvania. This year, they were taking the top two teams because they're not bringing international teams to Pennsylvania this year. So the top two participants in each one of the regions got to advance on. So we were the undefeated team going into the championship game. It just kind of had a flat one in the championship game, but we're still able to advance on out here to Pennsylvania.
Now, these games you talk about that took place in Indianapolis, are those the games that you played in Nebraska?
That is correct, yep. We beat Nebraska the first time around and lost to them in the championship game.
Now, interestingly enough, we're going to talk about this. I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit because in that first game against Nebraska, your ace pitcher, Gavin, threw a no-hitter, and boy, he is something else. And I know you don't want to exploit one player, but when you got a player of that caliber, talk about him and his ability on the mound.
He is he's special. I don't know what other word to describe. He's an unbelievable kid. He's a great kid. He's a great talented kid. He does it both at the plate and also, obviously on the mound. We just look back, and since All-Stars have started this year, he's actually pitched 25 innings for us, and he has 60 strikeouts and 2 walks. So, you just talk about a kid that's just absolutely dominant. Right now SportsCenter is out here. Baseball Tonight is out here, and I just continuously get requests every day for him to go on interviews on national TVs. And, there's a lot of people, talking about, he may be the best player, or probably is the best player, at this tournament. And now you're talking about, a worldwide tournament. So he's a talent that is that doesn't come along very often.
Now, it leads me to my next question. Are you, as a coach, are you limited to how much you can have players play? Or let's just stick with the pitching. Can they only pitch so many innings?
They can. Well, it's more on a pitch count. So how Little League Baseball does it is if he pitches more than 20 pitches in a game, he actually can't come back that following day. If we keep him under 20 pitches, then he can continue to pitch every single day that we're out here. There's certain criteria, up to 35 pitches, he has to wait 2 days, 55, he has to wait 3, over 65, 4, that type of stuff. So they put a real, real strong contingent on, when kids can and can't pitch. And he's one of our horses. So, usually when he's on the mound, he's out there to go and pitch the whole game. So usually when we pitch him, he'll have to rest 3 or 4 days and just can start.
If you're just joining us, our guest today is Coach Mike Gorsett from the Sioux Falls Little League team that is in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, taking part in the Little League World Series. And, Coach, we're going to stick with pitching because my guess is you're going to keep Gavin on the mound for tomorrow, and you're playing Louisiana. It's been said that their pitcher is an ace as well, so that's going to be quite the matchup.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that kind of predict our game as maybe the opening round game as far as having maybe the top two pitchers in the World Series going off against each other. So it's going to be maybe even for one run. So both pitchers are really, really good. Both teams are really, really good. I think it's going to be a battle tomorrow night that's going to be fun to watch on ESPN.
I know whatever decision you decide to make, it's always a tough decision because you want your best out there. And it sounds like Gavin, whether you choose to pitch him or not, it is totally your call. But we're looking forward to that. So let's get off of the pitching side of it and let's talk about the experience thus far. What are these kids experiencing up to this day?
You know, they're experiencing everything. I want to say they're experiencing everything, but unfortunately, they're only getting a real small taste of what it is out here. Normally, there's international teams running around. You know, normally, we're in kind of a dormitory, and I kind of look around. We got Ohio next to us, and Nebraska next to us, and Michigan next to us, and Florida is right next to us. Normally, all these kids are running through the rec center together. They're all jumping in the pool together. They're all normally interacting pretty heavily with each other. They don't let us do that this year. We're very much in our own little pod. South Dakota has to stay with South Dakota. They're COVID testing us, you know, every other day. So the pool, we can't interact together. You know, so it's really difficult from that standpoint that, you know, they don't get the full World Series experience, which I am, you know, I'm jealous of all the teams that have came before us and after us that they'll kind of get that experience. But they're obviously trying to keep us safe. You know, there was, I don't know what the number was, 5 or 6 teams that made it to the regional tournament that ended up, being sent home early with a positive COVID test. So the way that they handle things out here is one positive test sends your entire team home. So they're obviously doing their best. It's really difficult for our kids. Like I said, they are 12 years old. Some of these kids haven't seen their parents in 4 weeks. So it's one of those situations that they're going to remember this for the rest of their lives. It's an experience for the rest of their lives. But also, they're pretty homesick right now. They're definitely wanting to see their parents.
And that's on you, Coach. You got to keep your team together. And that's sometimes, you know, it's always fun to play the game, but it's hard to keep them together, isn't it?
That's 100% correct. You know, and like I said, they're 12-year-old boys. When you're around each other, how their sleeping quarters are 14 kids in one area. So they're bound to get on each other's nerves every once in a while. They're bound to, you know, have those squabbles. So it's trying to make sure that, you know, we're one big cohesive unit when we take that field tomorrow night. So we've been trying to do a lot of team bonding stuff. We had a Space Jam, movie night last night. We try to keep them pretty busy that they're not just, you know, sitting staring at walls all day long.
Coach, I've got so many thoughts and just not enough time. I'd like to wish you, the coach of the team, Mike Gorsett, and the best of luck tomorrow against Louisiana in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Congratulations on the journey thus far. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the entire state of South Dakota that's been behind us, and we appreciate every single one of you guys back there. Wouldn't rather be from any other state, so I appreciate that.
Sioux Falls Little League team plays Louisiana tomorrow at 4 p.m. Central. You can watch that on ESPN.